Shalom. And a little bit of old business, unfinished business. At lunch today was pointed out by several of the other teachers, there are only two other teachers, but so it was both of them, that when Norman Fisher, you know, Norman Fisher and I are sort of splitting the E-Camp duties this session. And Norman and I are very close friends and have been since we first met in 1968, and now we run a meditation center together, and we trained together for 10 years, and then I went on to become a rabbi, which everyone thought Norman was going to become. And Norman went on to become a Zen master, and nobody particularly thought that I would become that, so it's not, the symmetry is not perfect. But anyway, the other teachers pointed out that when Norman was here and he was teaching walking meditation, he said that you should step forward on the inhale and not the space in between the inhale and the exhale, as I had suggested. And not only that, they suggested that it was a lot easier that way, and it would have been a much better answer to your question. So, unfortunately, all I can tell you is that I'm quite sure as a consequence of this disagreement that Norman will fail to be enlightened, and I will. But, you know, having digested that very difficult piece of information, I suggest that you just do it whatever, if that works better for you, if it works better to move the foot on the inhale, by all means, do it. I mean, enlightenment is not really all that great in it. But I'd also would suggest, though, that it's my experience that when we really, the great thing about mindfulness is that it makes you incapable of almost everything. You know, I remember the first time I did a retreat, and people who were taught mindful walking of the other kind, the kind somebody else asked me about this morning, where you really focus on walking, and it was hysterical because there were a bunch of grown people falling on their faces. Because, you know, we do a lot of this, we take a lot of it for granted, and when we really focus at first, we lose our capacity to do it automatically. So that also could be what's going on. But if you want to try stepping on the inhale, be gesund. I want to talk that now for new business. I want to talk about leave-taking today, because I find it to be an important theme in spiritual practice generally, and particularly at a retreat like this, and particularly at an Eilat Chaim retreat, when we do at least three different kinds of very powerful leave-taking. First of all, just to come on a retreat. You know, we left. We physically and literally left. Wherever it was that we were, our lives there, all the things that we depend on to make ourselves feel comfortable and secure, and we came here. An unknown place, even more unknown than usual. It's amazing to me. Somebody mentioned this during the interview, and I realized that I really felt this way myself. This is a wonderful, beautiful place. But I find it strangely difficult to be here because it's not Eilat Chaim. And it is, even though I've only been to Eilat Chaim four or five times, it doesn't take us long to establish a sense of, you know, comfort and habit. And so here we are in Terra Incognita, having left home and coming here. And second of all, what we're doing here is meditation. Meditation is also, in many traditions, identified dafka as a leave-taking. In the Buddhist tradition, they call it the great home-leaving. And in Judaism, the most common word in Hebrew for meditation is hibbodedut, which means leave-taking, to cause yourself to be alone. That's literally, it's a hitpa'el verb, based on the shorish bode, to be alone. And the hitpa'el indicates reflexive action, so it's something that we cause ourselves to be. And of course, this retreat will climax with Shabbat. And Shabbat is also very specifically a leave taking, a time when all, you know, all these rules and restrictions, they really have the effect of liberating us from the world, allowing us to leave the world once a week and enter also a different kind of space. You know, I practice in the Zen tradition rather rigorously for 10 years, and then I came to Judaism. I can't really say I came back to Judaism, because I was never really, although I was born to a Jewish family, we were socialist, and I grew up on a kind of a commune, and my grandfather had been an Orthodox rabbi, and that's how much my father hated Judaism, And so I can't say I would return to it, but when I came to it after 10 years of Zen practice, I couldn't help seeing it through the lens, seeing Judaism, and particularly the sacred texts of Judaism, through the lens of that practice. And I think to a certain extent I still do. And one of the things I noticed was that the Torah, when I started studying Torah, it didn't seem to be about what everybody else said it was about. It didn't seem to be about the sacred history of our people, or it didn't seem to be a divine compendium of moral law. I think that was, you know, the particular fantasy of the rabbis. As wonderful a fantasy as it was, a fantasy that I live by, but nevertheless, not exactly what the Torah was. What the Torah seemed to me to be on virtually every page was the story of the encounter between the transcendent, the measureless, the nameless, and various human beings. Every page of the Torah either discussed that particular encounter, or prepared us for it, or spoke about the implications of it. And every one of those encounters was a transformation of a very significant sort. But that's not what I want to talk about today. I think I will talk about that later in the week, these transformations. What I want to talk about today is something else that struck me, and also very, very clear and very odd, and that is that every one of these encounter texts, every one of these transformation texts, was preceded by a leave-taking. Not once in the entire Torah does someone encounter God without first leaving everything that's familiar to them. And this is a very, very consistent motif. Starting with Abraham, the very first words that are recorded that God spoke to Abraham were, of course, what? Lech lecha. Leave. You know, definitely leave. Decidedly and decisively leave. Leave your home, leave your family, leave your country, leave everything that makes you feel comfortable and secure, and go where? Who cares? This is all about the leaving. El Eretz Asher Arecha, to a place to be named later. You know, a place, I'm not even going to bother to tell you what that place is, because for the moment it's irrelevant. What's important for the moment is that you leave. And the next great epiphany that we read about is Vayetze Yaakov, and Jacob left. You know, the vision of the ladder. And you think about just the opening line of that passage, Vayetze Yaakov, Miber Shava, Ve'elech Harana. And Jacob left Be'er Shava and went to Haran. Pretty straightforward passage, right? Wrong. Who talks like that? You know, I mean, I many of my friends knew that I was coming someplace this week. So they said, Alan, where are you going? And not one time did I say, I am leaving San Francisco and going to Eilat Chaim. Not once, because my friends are all very bright people. And I assume that if I tell them I'm going to Eilat Chaim, it goes without saying that I'm going to leave San Francisco. Because you can't get from San Francisco to Eilat Chaim without leaving San Francisco. It's not necessary to say it. And the Torah, which according to Rabbi Akiva is famously parsimonious about language and never wastes a word or a letter, nor even a jot or a squiggle, here appears to waste one entire half of a sentence, giving us absolutely useless information. unless, of course, we understand that the Torah is really trying to point out the importance of the leave-taking itself, which is exactly what Rashi says, by the way. Rashi notices this anomaly. What is the Torah? Hakon Nesil Chaynik. Of course he left Be'er Sheva. No, because the leaving itself was significant. And 20 years later, you know, here Yaakov was running away from his brother Esau, who wanted to kill him because he'd stolen first the birthright and then the blessing, etc., etc. And 20 years later, when he's coming back from Haran, because now his brother, now his uncle Laban wants to kill him. So apparently a very charming fellow, Yaakov. Wherever he goes, people want to kill him. So now he's coming back, and we get this big scene with him, you know, on the bank of the Yabok River, and he gathers all his family together. First he wants to split them up. You know, first he says, all right, you know, that Parsha begins, and he sent messengers, and the messengers came back, and they said, your brother Esau is coming towards you with 400 armed men. No, not a propitious sign. So Jacob says, all right, no problem. We have a river here. I'll take half my family. I'll put it on one side of the river. I'll take the other half of the family. I'll put it on the other side of the river. Esau kills one half of the family. I'll still have the other half left. So we begin to understand why everybody wanted to kill this guy. So we go through this, but then finally he sees a light in the middle of the night. I can't do this. And so he gathers his whole family together, and he puts them on one side of the Yabok River, and temporarily he goes over to the other side. And again, the Torah tells us something we don't need to know. Vayivater Yaakov livado. And Yaakov was left alone. Well, you just told us everybody was on one side of the river and he's on the other. But again, the Torah is trying to emphasize the fact that he took leave. And again, Vayivater Yaakov livado, livado, vad. It's the, again, hid bodidut. It's the same root, it's the same word. And when Moses is at the burning bush, double leave taking. First, he leaves Egypt. Why? Because Pharaoh wants to kill him. And then he goes out to Midian and he marries Yitro's daughter, and then he leaves everybody again. And he goes tending his sheep, Achar Amidbar, to the furthest region of the desert, as far away from everybody as he could get. And that's where he has his great epiphany, the vision of the burning bush. So, what is this all about? Why do all these people have to take leave? Why do they have to leave everything that makes them feel comfortable and secure in order to encounter the transcendent? And certainly one of the answers to this question is that by taking leave, they make themselves vulnerable. And when we're vulnerable, we're open. Usually we think in our ordinary lives that being vulnerable is not a good thing, and we try to protect ourselves against vulnerability. But you can't be open without also being vulnerable. So the very first thing that happens to these people is they kind of strip away their protection. And they also strip away conventional thinking. You know, Madame Blavatsky used to say, you know, the great spiritualist? Madame Blavatsky used to say that the reason everything in cities was concrete is because when so many people got together, their thought forms became so thick that they everything turned to concrete. And I think there's something to that. God is not found in our conventional idea of things. And so we have to get away from our conventional ideas. Nor is God found in habit. And I think this is perhaps the strongest point. We very quickly develop a habitual relationship to our experience without even noticing it. You know, or I didn't even notice. I only went to Eilat Chaim four or five times in my entire life. I find myself here in this very beautiful place, which objectively one might say is even more beautiful than Eilat Chaim is, and I'm longing for Eilat Chaim. The habit of being in Eilat Chaim is already very strong. God is here and now. God is in the moment. And the problem is that usually we are not. We are not here. We're in some habitual idea of here. We're in some fantasy of here. We are not seeing reality most of the time. We are seeing the habitual idea of reality. We are seeing a construct. We are not seeing the thing itself. We are seeing the idea of the thing. Or, you know, that's William Carlos Williams' beautiful, very beautiful summation of this problem. Let me tell you about an experiment that was once done at Princeton University. This was back in the 60s. Actually, a very close friend of mine was paid good money to be one of the subjects of this experiment. And the experiment, this was in the early days when Western scientists were first beginning to discover and become fascinated with meditation and yoga and the other Eastern spiritual arts. So they started to study these things very scientifically. So this was one of the early studies, and they took three groups. One was a group of people who did mindfulness meditation, Zen meditation, Zen adepts, and they put them in a room. And then they took another group of people who did Siddha yoga meditation, and they put them in a second room. And then they took a bunch of ordinary people like us. I know that none of you is ordinary, but people doing nothing special, sitting in a room. And what they did with all three groups was very simple. Of course, they had them all hooked up to brainwave machines and galvanic skin measuring devices, whatever they are. And they rang a bell at periodic intervals. And they measured the response of these three groups. And to me, by far the most interesting group was the test group, because their results provided such an incredibly precise snapshot of how we live. Which is to say, when they rang the bell the first time, everybody in this test group registered maximum possible response. They were very surprised to hear this bell ring. And the second time, they also registered a big response. And then the third time, the response was less. And then each time they rang the bell, it got increasingly less and less, increasingly less. here's the part that gives us such an accurate picture of how we live. Finally, they stopped registering the bell at all. The bell was ringing away, but they had become so habituated to it that they didn't hear it at all. And this may sound like surprising news, but this is what our lives are like. We walk around with such a strong sense of habit that our lives fail to register on us. By the way, just because the other two groups, just because people are curious, and they would say, "Rabbi, you never said what those other two groups did." I'll tell you. The Zen adepts registered complete shock with every ringing of the bell. The Siddha yoga adepts never registered anything. They were elsewhere altogether. So, yeah, you know, this. My wife, Cheryl, who was here with me, not at the retreat, but she's here at in my room, is a novelist. And her first novel was called This Flower Only Blooms Every 100 Years, was about every vacation that she ever took. Why did she choose this theme? Because she realized, you know, really, from the time she was a child, the earliest vacation she could remember until the time she wrote the book. That was the structure of the book. And she chose that structure because she realized that when she was on vacation, she was subject to neither the habits of the place she had left or the habits of the place she had come to. So she registered that place very sharply. That's why we love vacations, you know, because we're finally flush with our experience, even if it's just for a week. Krishnamurti used to recommend a practice which I actually do occasionally until everybody I know threatens to kill me, like Yaakov. And that is that he says that we should train ourselves whenever anybody asks us a question, any kind of question, the simplest kind of question imaginable, we should train ourselves to say, "I don't know," whatever the question is. No. What's your favorite color? "I don't know." No. See, for me, I have no idea what my favorite color is. When I was 3 years old, I decided that blue was my favorite color. Now, every time somebody asks me, what's your favorite color, I say blue. But I haven't stopped to consider, you know, what color I actually do love now since I was 3 years old. But if I said, I don't know, I would create this moment of leave-taking, where I would leave yesterday's Torah and connect to the Torah peculiar to today. That's the Sfat Emet's language. The Sfat Emet explains why it is that we connect Pesach to Shavuot with the counting of the Omer. You know, we do that. There's 50 weeks between Passover and, 50 days. Yep. 50 days, 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuot, and we count that time ritually. And the Sfat Emet says that it's because Pesach is the time of leave-taking. It's Zman Cherutenu, it's the time of liberation. And Shavuot is the time of Matan Toretenu, the time of the giving of our Torah, the time of revelation. And we can only experience revelation to the degree that we've done leave-taking, to the degree that we've let go of yesterday's Torah. That's the only way we can experience the Torah that's peculiar to today. This is, if the Sfat Emet didn't say it, I couldn't say it. Let go of yesterday's Torah. All those assumptions that have gone stale without our noticing it. Now, let me just address two other aspects of this leave-taking motif before I actually get to the seminal moment of leave-taking. One I haven't mentioned yet. That is, of course, Yitziat Mitzrayim. Right? Oh, I did just mention it. That's what Pesach is. I believe the exodus from Egypt. Before I get there, though, I want to address another aspect of this phenomenon, which is the running for their life motif. You know, Jacob and Moses and Abraham, they're not going on vacations like my wife. They're running for their lives, literally. They're running at a position of Abraham, and the Midrash provides the information that Abraham is running away from his father who wants to kill him because he smashed all his idols. Jacob, by the Peshat of the Torah twice, you know, he runs away from Laban who wants to kill him. He runs away from Esau who wants to kill him. The Pharaoh runs away from, Moses runs away from Pharaoh. So what's all this about? You know, I once made these remarks at a retreat with Sylvia Borstein, and she said, oh, it's quite clear to her what it's about. It's about the fact that when you take leave in the way that we're talking about now, it's as if you're running to life. You know, you're literally running for your life. You're trying to smash through the living death of habit and recapture life. And before we go any further with this idea of leave-taking, it should be pointed out, it's a funny thing to talk about at a retreat where we're telling you, you know, be exactly where you are and be exactly who you are. You know, but the one thing you have to understand about this is that this is like baseball, this kind of leave-taking, you know, which is to say that you leave home in order to get home. You know, or it's like the that great shortstop Odysseus. You know, it's like the Odyssey. You know, also you leave. You have to leave. It's this business, this retreat that we're at now. This business of meditation. This business of Shabbat. These are all home leavings that we make. L'shem arriving at home, you know, for the sake of coming home in the deepest possible way. And that's, I think, what Sylvia was pointing out. But I think there's something else here, too. And that is, no sane person leaves everything that makes them feel comfortable and secure voluntarily. You know, usually we only do so at the point of a gun. And life is very accommodating. Life will very frequently push us to that point. But the moment of leave-taking is the moment when we know we have to do something, when the present is absolutely unbearable, but we have no idea what to do. It's when we lose a loved one and we just can't bear the loss. We don't know how we're going to go on with it. Or we can't stand our job one day longer. Every day there is a torment. And we feel if we go there one more day, we're just going to die from the pain of it. But how can we leave? Who's going to support our family? We're in a relationship, and it's untenable, too full of pain and hurt to endure, and nothing we do seems to work. But how could you live without him? Or a child is having an intractable problem. You can't stand to see them suffer, but nothing you do seems to help. Or the pain in your knee becomes absolutely unbearable. Or the boredom you feel just sitting there hour after hour becomes unbearable. Or the rage that wells up every time you sit and become quiet is unbearable. See, meditation mimics this quality that life has, this tendency that life has to bring us to moments of leave-taking. Now, I have to tell you, in my opinion, it's a pretty pale imitation. Knee hurting, intractable problem with the child. You know, we're not talking about a level playing field here. And it also needs to be acknowledged that these kind of leave-taking moments that we're talking about can just as easily devastate us as bring us into encounter with the transcendent. You know, there are many people who become broken by these experiences. And so one of the values of meditation to me, and one of the values of spiritual practice in general, it can't really replicate, it can't do for you what life does for you. But what it does is it sensitizes us to the potential in these leave-taking moments, so that when they occur in life, we are somewhat more likely to see them that way than we would be if we had no spiritual practice. One more point that I want to get. You know, this is not just a Jewish or a biblical phenomenon, by the way. This is an absolutely universal spiritual archetype that we find in virtually every religious tradition. Buddha, you know, his famous home leaving. Buddha was the son of wealthy aristocrats, and like all people in the upper middle class and higher, they tried to protect their son from suffering. In fact, they tried to prevent him from ever seeing suffering. They kept him locked up in the house. But then he became a teenager, and like all good teenagers, he ran away from home. And he went out on the street, and he was absolutely devastated by the suffering he was seeing there for the first time. And so he left home, vowing never to return until he had solved the dilemma of human suffering. And Jesus went out into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights and struggled with the temptations. And Muhammad was driven out of Mecca. Yes, driven out of Mecca. And he had to run all the to Ahar HaMidbar, just like Moses, to the furthest reaches of the Arabian desert. In this case, oddly enough, to a Jewish city, Medina, at the northern edge of the Arabian Peninsula. So this is an absolutely consistent archetype. In every religion of the world, somebody takes leave, they encounter the transcendent, they come back, they tell everybody about it. That's how religions are born. A significant departure from this archetype is the Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt, because here, everybody leaves, and everybody has the encounter with the transcendent at Mount Sinai. And from that moment forward, there's a reconfiguration of the idea of leave-taking in Jewish thought. Because it can no longer mean actually leaving. Because that becomes, I mean, the communitarian value becomes almost absolute. Al tifrotz min hatzibur. Don't leave the community under any circumstances. So leave-taking can no longer mean packing your bags and, you know, going to Philadelphia. It becomes internalized. And it comes to stand for the idea of leaving our ordinary consciousness, leaving our habitual relationship to our experience, and entering an extraordinary, concentrated, and focused state of mind. Hit bodedut. And actually, the idea of leave-taking was retranslated in each of the traditions that I mentioned earlier in very similar ways. It was internalized. What it had become, you know, because you think about it, if you just keep physically leaving, you know, if you do serial leave taking, you're just an escapist. You know? But we're talking about believing to become exactly who we are and to experience our lives in a very precise way. And what's interesting to me is that this is really, this Yitziat Mitzrayim is really the seminal moment of leave-taking. And I always thought, it's different from the other leave-takings, and it's the one that this entire religious enterprise flows from. And so I always thought if you looked at this moment very carefully, you would find out something interesting about the process of leave-taking. And lo and behold, you do. Because if we look closely at the moment of leaving Egypt, the moment when they leapt into the sea, what we see is precisely a five-step program for dealing with intractable suffering, for dealing with that kind of moment I was speaking about earlier, for dealing with that moment where you know you have to do something and you have absolutely no idea what to do. You know, that moment when Pharaoh's army is coming at you from behind and there's nothing but the sea in front of you. And a five-step program is very good. It's very economical. It's five less than the Ten Commandments. It seems, at first blush to be one more than the Four Noble Truths, but the Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Noble Path. So we're way ahead of the game. But it's really striking because what we find here at the precise moment of leave-taking is five very strong verbs, almost one after another. Four uttered by Moses and one uttered by God. It's a collaboration. And it's just, you all know this scene because depending on how old you are, you saw either the Cecil B. DeMille or the Steven Spielberg version of this story. So I don't have to give you too much background. But, you know, the children of Israel leave, and then the Pharaoh thinks better about it, so he sends out his chariots after, the Israelites. 600 of his choicest chariots with three armed soldiers in each chariot. Pretty scary. You know, that's at least 1,800 armed Egyptians. And they go out, and the Israelites look up, and they see these Egyptians coming, and one of them, an unidentified Israelite, but I can tell you he was the karmic ancestor of Henny Youngman, because this is like a real Borscht Belt line. He says, "What's the matter? They didn't have enough graves in Egypt? You had to take us out here in the desert to die?" This is what he says, quite literally. And this is when Moses and God respond with these five verbs. And it's a very interesting program. First, Moses says, "Al tira'u," which means, don't be afraid. It doesn't really mean, don't be afraid. If you're afraid, you're afraid. I used to have an uncle who used to say, if you're scared, say scared. And that is a point of view that has held up very well for me all my life. So it doesn't mean pretend you're not afraid or try to make yourself not be afraid. What it means, and particularly in this context, you can see, is stop running around in a panic about things that aren't real. Al-tira'u. Rabbi Nachman said that suffering is being afraid of things that we don't need to be afraid of, being afraid of things that we only imagine are going to harm us or threaten us. And this covers 99% of the things that we're afraid of. And this fear controls our life, this fear of phantoms. And we see this here in this scene. I just gave you a mathematical breakdown of the military force that the Pharaoh sent after the Israelites. 1,800 men. Wow. You know, there were 2 million Israelites, and the Torah is very careful to point out, they were also armed. So why were 2 million Israelites so frightened of 1,800 Egyptians? Never mind, they had very nice chariots. All right, I'll grant you that. Rashi points out an anomaly in the text that's really interesting. In verse 9, it says, V'yirdifu ha-mitzrim achareichem. The Egyptians chased after them. Both subject and verb in the plural. A half a verse later, it says, U'mitzrayim noseya achareichem. And Egypt came after them. So one half of a sentence later, now the verb and the subject are in the singular. What does this mean? Rashi, with his usual pithy brilliance, has a two-word commentary to explain this anomaly. That the second time describes what the Israelites saw. The first time describes what happened objectively. The second time describes what the Israelites saw. And the Israelites saw a singular. Sar Mitzrayim. The spirit of Egypt, their idea of Egypt. Not what was really there, but their idea, an idea that had been formed in 400 years of slavery. You know? So, this Penny Youngman character, he wasn't seeing what was there. He was seeing what was in his imagination, and it terrified him. What was there was 1,800 lousy Egyptians. You know, one of the most significant leave-takings of my own life was when I left law school. You know, I grew up in the kind of family where it was quite clear that there were only two alternatives for life. To become a doctor, there was really only one alternative, and one B. And if you couldn't be a doctor, then you could be a lawyer. But that was it. Life only held these two possibilities. And, you know, when I went to college at the University of Pennsylvania, on my first day of chemistry, I smashed a scale that was so delicate, it cost like $25,000. And I went in and tried to do an experiment, and the scale went shattering on the floor. And the next thing you know, I was in the dean of the chemistry department's office, and he said to me, "I'll make you a deal. You will pass this course if you promise never to set foot in this department again." So I said, "Deal." You know, and that was the end of my medical career. So there was nothing left for me but law school. And I struggled through the first year of law school. You know, there was something, you know, constitutional law. And, you know, learning the law is a great, if you have an aptitude for it, it's a great way to spend your life. I did not. So I struggled through the first year, and then the second year, the first thing that happened was the uniform commercial code, and I was a dead Jew. There was no way that I was going to, you know, no way I was going to make it. So I decided I had to leave law school because it was quite clear if I stayed, I would flunk out anyway. So I called my parents up on the phone and I explained that I was going to leave law school. My father screamed and yelled. My mother cried. And then I got off the phone and I lay down on the sofa in my apartment and waited to die. And this sounds like an outlandish joke or something, but this was no joke. I was quite convinced that I was going to die. I laid there because I had just consumed all the possibilities for life, you know. And so I laid on that sofa all night long. And when the next day came and I was still alive, I realized I'd been running away from a phantom all my life. You know, Al Tirau. I'd been running away from a terror of something that wasn't real. That there really were other possibilities in life. And that was really the beginning of my life. I think that night, or that morning, when I woke up. So that's step number one. Al Tirau. And it's a very real step. And I hope that this week, you become aware of some of the terrors that hold you in their thrall without your realizing it. Some of the phantoms. Some of the Sar Mitzrayims. Some of the ideas of Egypt that are limiting your life. It's a very valuable thing to see. But when we see it, the second step, and the second word, the very next word in the Torah that Moses utters is Hityatzvu. Hityatzvu. Very beautiful words. It's from the shortest Netzav. You know, like Parsha Netzavim. It means to stand, but not in the...
in the way that, you know, a human being stands erect. It means more to make a stand, you know, to take a position. It's etymologically from a Ugaritic word for building, for construction, for gathering materials together, for concentrating materials in a single place to construct something. It corresponds to the in-breath. It corresponds to the gathering in of the tzitzit that Jeff was talking about. It corresponds to that sense of gathering, of bringing ourselves to the center of our being, of focusing, that we experience in meditation. So, hityatzvu, be with your fear. Stop running around in a panic. Stop trying to get away from your fear. But pull yourself together and stand with it. Stand still and see. Stand still and let reality come into focus. Let it arise as it is. As opposed to the rage for action with which we usually deal with feelings of fear. I'm afraid I'm going to do something about it. You know, as I mentioned in the instructions for meditation this morning, this is why we try not to move in meditation. We're looking for a different kind of answer. We're looking for a hityatzvu kind of answer. Not, okay, I'm afraid my knee is going to fall off if I stay in this position 1 second longer, so I'm going to take action and move. But hityatzvu, what would happen if I stood that fear down? Standing still is the leave-taking that leads to the divine encounter. The essential act of leave-taking is a turn towards stillness. And the third step, the very next word that's uttered after that, these words come one after another, is uru. Al tira'u, stop running around in a panic. Hityatzvu, collect ourselves. Make ourselves still, uru, and see. And then we see what's really there, and not that phantom that we imagine to be there. This is the consequence of leave-taking. We see what's there instead of the phantoms that used to hold us in their thrall. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. That's a word that occurs three times in Tanakh, twice in Psalms, and once in the book of Job. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. It's mourning. You're not really going to die because you quit law school. Your knee is not really going to fall off because it hurts. There's a wonderful story in the book of Kings. It's the Haftar that we read with Parsha Mitzorah every year, the one about leprosy. And it's about four lepers. And they're in the town of Shumran. And the town of Shumran is under siege. Excuse me, they're not in the town because they're lepers. They're outside of the town because that's what happened when you were a leper. They put you outside. They forced you to take leave. And the town of Shumran was under siege by the Aramaeans. And the siege got really bad, and it's one of those scenes like you read in Jeremiah and in Lamentations, you know, where people are eating. Well, never mind. They're really horrifying scenes. You know, everybody's really starving. And so they stop, of course, they stop putting food out for the lepers, as they used to do. And so the lepers start to starve. So the lepers say to each other, well, look, it can't get any worse than this. Let's go into the Aramaean camp and ask them for food. The worst they can do is kill us. We're going to die anyway, so who cares? So they go into the Aramaean camp. There's nobody there. And from the looks of things, there hasn't been anybody there for a long time. The city of Shumran has been held under siege by a phantom, by something that isn't there. And it took the outsiders. This is kind of a paradigm. The vision of the outsiders, the visions of the ones who have taken leave, to see what's really there. It takes that sense of having nothing left to lose. And then the next step is tacharishun, which also means be still. Well, you just told me be still 2 words ago. No, this is the stillness that comes as a consequence. The first stillness was something that we do. We make ourselves still. And then we see what's really there. And this is a really beautiful thing, and I think you'll find it's true. When we start to see the things that we spend our whole life energy denying, when we finally see them, there's a tremendous sense of relief. We've been so terrified of these things all our lives that really a good part of our life energy goes into pretending that they're not there. But when we do see them, we feel calm. When we really see the truth, when we really acknowledge the truth, we feel this tremendous sense of calm. It feels good, even if the truth is something awful. Even if the truth is something we might very well have been afraid to look at. It's still the truth, and it has the quality to calm us. So this tahari, you know, I remember last year at this retreat, we did a retreat at Eilat Chaim last year, Jeffrey and I and Sheila Weinberg-Peltz. And, you know, I was trained in the Zen tradition, and I had never really done a retreat with Vipassana people before. You know, and Jeffrey, and not Jeffrey and Sheila studied in the Vipassana tradition. And so they were doing this practice, which of course I knew about, but I had never actually done it, to tell you the truth, and I'm sure it's a technique I'll share with you later in the week, of noticing mind states and taking note as to whether they're pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. I don't think anybody has yet identified a neutral mind state. You know? But so I did this practice, and I was really kind of taken with it because I had never done it before, and I noticed that it really was tremendously calming just to see some way you were feeling, even if it was some way that you were feeling that made you feel terrible, and just to say, oh, this is unpleasant. As soon as you said, oh, this is unpleasant, it calmed down. You know, you felt a sense of stillness about it. It was really quite remarkable. And it was a good thing that I learned that technique, because on the way home from the retreat, somebody dropped me at the airport, and I was feeling so wonderful. It was a really lovely retreat. And I was feeling so wonderful, and of course, an airport can really kick that out of you, you know. And this was at Newark, and there was absolute chaos. There had been some rainstorms, a lot of flights had been canceled. There was a line that went three times around the airport at the Delta counter where I had to go to learn that my flight had been canceled. And they spent 45 minutes serving two people. And the line didn't move for 45 minutes. It was a very long line. And meanwhile, every minute that we stand there, people are missing planes. And I have what Sigmund Freud calls anxiety at the train station. This is just the kind of thing that makes me crazy, you know. And I was standing in line, and this terrible anxiety would rise up, and I would say, this is extremely unpleasant. And this wonderful calm would come over me, and I kept doing it, like I had to do it every second. This is really unpleasant. You thought that was unpleasant. But it was just remarkable just to say that, just to see the truth. There's some wonderful calm that comes. So now here comes the best part to me. And this is, of course, it would be the best part, because it's the part that's uttered by God. The last part. What does God say? We said, Altira'u, stop running around in the panic. Kityatzvu, be still, gather yourself. Uru, and see what's really there instead of that phantom you were running away from. Vetacharishun, and once you see what's really there, this stillness will come over you. So what does God say? Yisau, get going. Is God trying to imply that Moses, his servant and prophet, is an idiot? Moses just told us, not once, not twice, no, excuse me, twice, to be still, and God says, get going. But there's no contradiction. This is to me the best part. And it's an answer that comes out of that stillness, that comes out of tacharishun, that comes out of that emptiness. This get going is not something that we create. This get going is not a product of the ego. This get going is not something that we figure out by making lists, pros and cons. But it's something that comes to us. It's the action which flows out of this leave-taking, this stillness, this concentration. It's what they call in Taoism, wu wei, non-doing. You know? Back in the 60s, when my friends and I encountered the idea of Wu Wei, we thought, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Non-doing, a religious and theological justification for the way that we live. You know? And it was one of the crushing disappointments of my young life when I discovered that it really didn't mean not doing anything. Except, you know, listening to the Beatles. It meant acting without a sense of being the actor. Acting without ego. Allowing the next inevitable action to arise. Perfect alignment with what's happening. The action which arises seamlessly out of the moment. You know, it's a wonderful passage in Pirkei Avot. They ask all the rabbis, what's the most important quality to have? And one says, a good heart. And of course, how could you be wrong with that answer? And another says, you know, a good mind. And so they all have different answers. But my favorite answer is, Haroeh et hanolad, the one who sees what is being born. The one who is so in tune with the moment that he sees the future arising out of it. That she senses the next action that the moment demands. God will fight for you, and you will be quiet. Non-doing, just doing what must be done next. So this is really fascinating to me. You know, this theme is so important in the Torah, in meditation, in Shabbat, in retreats, this moment of leave-taking. And this is what we see when the rubber hits the road. This is the moment of leave-taking life pushes us to. This is the moment of leave-taking meditation pushes us to. The moment when we realize that we just can't go on the way we've been going. When we feel that we have to do something, and we have no idea what to do, or even how to endure the next moment. And this, according to the Torah, is what we should do. 5 easy steps. Al tirau. Stop running around in a panic. Stop trying to get away from phantoms. Stop trying to get away from fears that don't exist, from stories that we've been telling ourselves. Kityatzvu. Gather ourselves and be with the moment, fearful or not. Woo. And as a consequence of this stillness that we brought ourselves to, seeing what's really there, tacharishun, and then feeling the calm and the stillness that comes very deeply from seeing the truth, v'yisa'u, and taking the next inevitable action that arises of its own accord out of the stillness, out of the emptiness. But let me reduce it even further. Let me reduce it to 2 steps. Be still and get going. God will fight for you. The universe will conspire to show you the next step that you have to take. If you'll just be still. Thank you.